Not Gen X, not Gen Y, the lost generation. Today, Friday, December 19th, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The plan to normalize U.S.-Cuba relations leaves one Cuban exile with mixed emotions.
It's a sweet and sour news. A news, no matter how good it is, if it comes late, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Also trying to understand the acceptance of harsh terrorism methods among many Christian Americans.
It is deeply ironic, paradoxical, and troubling that those who worship Jesus Christ, who was tortured, would support the torture of anyone.
Plus, a clock change in Russia has Siberians up earlier and up in arms.
So the way it is now, the day starts 2 hours earlier, and the sun goes down barely after 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. I tried several times in the late 90s and early 2000s to go to Cuba. Twice, my visa request fell on deaf ears at the Cuban interest section in Washington. But then in 2004, no explanation, I was granted a visa to travel as a journalist to the island. The man on the ground, my fixer, who helped introduce me to a mix of Cubans, was Yuro Leyva Lopez. He's a musician and a photographer and a child of the revolution. His grandfather was a revolutionary, so was his dad. Yuro himself was so compelling, he became a subject of my reporting, and we've stayed in touch since then. Yuro is part of the generation of Cubans known as the Lost Generation, the ones who came of age after the fall of the Soviet Union and the loss of all those Russian oil for sugar subsidies. Here's Yuro in 2004 in Havana, giving me his alternate name for the Lost Generation.
The ones that did not leave. We are not a large group of Cubans who decided to stay in Cuba, having the talents to make a living and have a better life out of Cuba.
The ones who did not leave. Yuro Leyva Lopez joins me now from his home in Madrid in Spain. So you are part of the ones who did leave, Yuro, ultimately. Remind me what year that was.
I left the island in 2007. I guess the waiting went too long for me, and I saw that youth and that spirit of fight and of survivor inside the island a little bit lost.
And when you say the waiting, there was too much waiting, what were you waiting for?
I was waiting exactly for what's happening right now, what it looks like is happening right now. I always hoped that in a certain point, the United States and Cuban's government will realize how awkward and how pointless the policy on the embargo and the auto-embargo was not going to work for any of the people. At the end, governments are supposed to be there for the good of the people, for the good of Cuban and the United States people. And that wasn't happening.
I know this has been a bumpy year for you. You've got a kid, but your partner has been ill, so you've been juggling the child rearing and your own work as a photographer and musician. And then your mother also left Cuba this year to join you in Spain and help out. So I'm just curious, what went through your mind when you heard of the new normalization of relations between the U.S. and Cuba? What did you think?
It was received at first as a good news. But for a lot of Cubans like me, for my mother, for a lot of Cubans, it's a sweet and sour news.
And why sour?
First of all, it's a late news. And we both know that a news, no matter how good it is, if it comes late, it doesn't make a lot of sense. I do feel great about the new generation who's going to be satisfied and is going to be pleased from this new approach between the United States and Cuba. But then I also think about how many Cubans from my generation and before lost a lot and left a lot behind and had to leave the island, had to fight to get to a certain point in life to have a better life. No?
Like what? What did you leave behind?
I left everything behind, my friends, my career, my family. I even had to sell my house. And as you remember, I had a beautiful home on the beach there.
Fantastic home. We went swimming in the Caribbean together just outside
exactly.
Your house. Unbelievable.
Exactly. I mean, regret in a certain point that I had to sell my house, that I had to leave. A house that I was working on for my entire life. It was the closest thing for me as home. and I had to leave everything behind. So as much as I worked and as much as I sacrificed, it didn't work. It just got to the point of what I always call the seawall. You know, there was always a wall to, no matter how much you work, how much you accomplish, you were always going to have that wall there, you know.
The fact that you had to sell the family house just outside Havana, how big a moment was that for you in terms of your connection to Cuba? Was it like burning the last bridge to home?
Almost. I have a bigger bridge that keeps me very close to Cuba and very close to my people, which is my culture.
Does it help, Euro, that a lot of like-minded Cubans like you have done the same thing? They've left the island and a lot of them have landed in Madrid. I mean, do you talk about these things?
We do. Actually, in general, the feeling is a feeling of happiness. You know, it's a feeling of, at last, we're looking, at least we didn't go as, you know, my grandparents, for example, they didn't see this happen. You know, they died and didn't see this happen. So at least we saw it. It's like, sometimes you thought that you would never see this happen, you know, that this game between governments and between the powers was going to be played forever. And now at least there's a sense of happiness that, you know, we were there when this happened, you know?
So will you go back to Cuba? Do you think for many Cubans who left, is it too late to go back and start over?
Yeah, for a lot of Cubans, it is late. I mean, like, for example, me, I have a family here. I have my son. My son is Spanish. I'm pretty sure that a lot of Cubans have the same sense. A lot of Cubans are looking at this as an opportunity to go back and start over again, you know, and I respect that. But you have to remember, there's also another huge blockade. There's another huge embargo, which is the embargo that the Cuban government does to the Cubans. And that's another embargo that needs to be ended. When Cubans will have the opportunity of doing a real, real free trading without having to pay huge taxes on it, when Cubans will have the opportunity of investing real money in Cuba, not just a few thousands, but millions, these Cubans need to have the opportunity to do something better, capitalistically speaking, inside Cuba. And for that, we need to end the Cuban embargo for the Cubans.
Euro Leyva Lopez, thank you so much. Great to speak with you again.
Always a great pleasure talking to you, Marco.
That was Euro Leyva Lopez, who I worked with more than 10 years ago in Havana. He's a son of a Cuban revolutionary. He now lives in Madrid. Cuba is also famously analog. A tiny percentage of the island's 11 million residents have access to the internet. So there's a lot of hope that renewed relations between the U.S. and Cuba will greatly increase that access. Doug Maduri is director of internet analysis for Dyn Research. He's in New Hampshire, and he's been following Cuba's internet saga for some time now. Doug, I was there in 2004, and I could not believe I was actually hearing dial-up bleeps in Cuba. I thought that might have improved some, but apparently not. You and your company actually broke the news 2 years ago about the activation of the first submarine cable connecting Cuba to the global internet. Who built and financed that, and what difference has it made?
Yes, the Alba One submarine cable was financed by the Venezuelan government and built by Alcatel submarine cables out of France. And we can test from here that it's improved their connectivity to the outside world. However, the improvement to of greater access to the people of Cuba, that's still slow going.
Yeah, it's not like you could go on YouTube and watch a TV show or anything right now in Cuba.
I doubt it.
Is the lackluster expansion of internet access in Cuba since that submarine cable was activated, is it a technical issue or a political issue?
Well, they have made a couple of modest steps towards greater access. So they opened up a number of kind of government-run internet cafes for the public. That was an opening. But the cost was fairly high for the average Cuban. It was $4 an hour, something around there, which is cost prohibitive for the average Cuban. Plus, from the reports of people who were getting on it, it was also heavily censored. But that was a very small step towards greater access. They've also made, the state telecoms made announcements about running internet service like DSL lines to residential customers, as well as having a mobile service. But it's been pretty slow.
So if the cost came down, is the cable that's there now, is the pipe wide enough that a lot of people could get online?
Yeah, I think that cable would serve them well. They may eventually grow out of it, but compared to what they're using now, they could stand to benefit a lot from full usage of that submarine cable.
So I know you've studied other kind of analog countries trying to improve access to internet. Is there a model out there that you think Cuba could follow?
Yeah, I do. I bet a lot of people in the telecom space, when there was all this discussion about Cuba possibly opening up, their minds probably just went to Myanmar, where that country also just opened up to the world. Yeah, formerly Burma, opened up 3 years ago. And they got a lot of good advice from outside experts, including the World Bank, of how to hold auctions, how to let outside companies come in and do what they do, do a rapid deployment and allow them to do investment and infrastructure in the country. And we're just seeing the beginning of the product of that. It's been good news so far. The service in Myanmar is still not up to the standards we would be happy with in the West. But what's most important is that the trajectory they're on is a very positive one. In the example of Myanmar, you have Telenor out of Norway, was one of the winners of the two mobile licenses. They paid $500 million for a 15-year license to the government of Myanmar. And on top of that, they are pledging to spend another $1 billion putting in their own infrastructure to provide service to 90% of the population in some pretty inhospitable conditions for technical space. This is the jungles of Southeast Asia. They're going to put in infrastructure. I think the island of Cuba would be a lot easier to work in. So the government of Cuba could expect something akin to those numbers as far as revenue, and the outside companies would come in and they could do the infrastructure. They just need to oversee the process.
To date, has Cuba tried to basically do it themselves?
Yes. The state telecom is doing this, and I think they're doing an admirable effort for what they're trying to do. But I think just like in Myanmar, NPT is the state telecom there, and they were wise enough to know to just not think that the state telecom is going to be the one that's equipped to do a rapid deployment of a mobile service. And I think in Cuba, no knock on Texas there, but they need to just let the outside experts come in and do what they do. I think everybody involved, the people of Cuba, the government of Cuba, and the outside companies would all benefit from being able to operate there. I think what's most important in the agreement on Wednesday was this pledge by the government to provide greater access to the internet. And I don't know what the details of that are going to be, but maybe this is going to give them some cover or provide them the opportunity to hold a mobile license auctions and let these companies come in and do what they're designed to do.
Doug Midori directs internet analysis and also blogs for Dyne Research in New Hampshire. Thank you, Doug.
Yep, thank you.
Here at The World, we get a lot of press and review copies of books. In fact, there is usually a stack of them in our newsroom. Luckily, we're very into reading, so here's a quick random selection of some of our top reads of 2014.
I'm Shefali Kulkarni. I am the digital producer for PRI.org's Global Nation Desk. And one great book that I read this year was Asif Manvi's No Land's Man. It's not your typical story of the immigrant experience, but this book, No Land's Man, is a really hilarious collection of stories about Asif Manvi's life growing up in an Indian Muslim household. He's got a lot of really funny stories in there, like the time he performed Michael Jackson's Billie Jean in front of his high school, or how he became The Daily Show's Muslim correspondent, even though he's been to more bars than mosques.
Hi, I'm Stephen Davey, multimedia editor for The World. My book this year is by Ethan Zuckerman, and his book is titled Rewire, Digital Cosmopolitans in the Age of Connection. It's a real reboot of our thinking on what a cosmopolitan is in our age of fast-paced media and, our deeply connected world. I really responded to it. And the promise of the open internet is that cosmopolitanism, it should be getting easier, really, but that's not always the case. And Zuckerman argues that we can do better, and, you know, we really should.
My name is Bradley Campbell, and I'm a producer here at The World, and I chose The Shadow Hero by Gene Luen Yang and Sonny Liu. It's kind of this origin story about a Golden Age comic book hero known as the Green Turtle. And he is the very first Asian-American superhero. But this book, it's got everything. You've got turtle spirits, white-suited gangsters, gorgeous, gorgeous illustrations. And what I loved, this kind of beautiful story about a mother and her superhero son. So phenomenal storytelling, phenomenal illustrations, and just an all-around great book.
Thank you, pals. Want to know my book pick of the year? You can find that and the rest of our top reads at PRI.org. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's a victory, perhaps a small one, but a victory still. Kurdish forces in northern Iraq say they've broken the ISIS siege of Mount Sinjar. That's a mountain where thousands of Yazidi and other displaced Iraqis have been trapped since August. The offensive began on Wednesday morning with a big bombardment by American and coalition jets. The airstrikes opened a wide corridor to the Yazidis and others trapped on the mountaintop. My BBC colleague G.R. Gol is in Erbil in Iraq. What's happening now on Mount Sinjar? Are the Kurds fully in control?
Ground troops from the ground has reached to the top of the mountain. They rejoined their forces, the Kurdish fighters, in the top of the mountain. Those forces has been protecting Yazidis in the past few months that they were trapped on top. So there is a lot of optimism in Kurdish region, particularly in the refugee camps, Yazidi refugee camps. The news was received with joy. Many people are hoping this small victory, as you mentioned, paved the way to recapture the entire region, Sinjar city and the villages around it.
So Kurdish forces on the ground, but major support from American jets in the air, correct?
It was crucial. I talked to one of the commanders. He said there was a precise, he called it, this is what he said, it's a precise coordination between ground and the air. And we are suspecting there must be some American special forces on the ground giving, coordinate this kind of airstrikes from the air between the fighter jets, drones, and ground forces. And, of course, we haven't seen the American military visible, they are not visible. We haven't seen them. But what we are hearing from the Kurdish commanders, they are present. They are embedded with the Kurdish forces in the front line.
So can the Kurds hold on to the mountain now that they've taken it?
Well, the mountain, still, there's a large area surrounding the mountain is in the control of IS militants. There is another corridor from Mount Sinjar to Syrian Kurdistan, which was opened early in August by Kurdish fighters in Syria. So this one is more important. Why? Because from Iraqi Kurdistan, they can send humanitarian aid, basic needs, food to the mountain via land. And those people who choose to come down from the mountain, go to refugee camps in around the cities like Duhok and Zahu, they can come down. So this area, still there is a the big area is under the control of IS militants.
And for those people who've been trapped on the mountain, if they choose to use that corridor and get off the mountain, go to those refugee camps, what kind of risks are they running?
Well, this is something the Kurdish security forces said. They don't want the civilian face risk, because when the IS militants has retreated, obviously they have left behind booby traps, IEDs, mine, and explosive had been mounted across the along the roads, villages, in the houses. So they say they have to clean it up. And this might slow down if they want to bring down the civilian from the mountain to Iraqi Kurdistan.
So will the offensive continue now to get rid of more ISIS militants and make more corridors for those people trapped on the mountain?
I think right now what we are hearing from the Kurdish forces, they talk about recapturing the entire region of Sinjar. They said they have the momentum. Obviously, many of those IS militants in some area, they drop their gun, they left their even heavy weapons, they run. That's what we saw. And even in one village, I was talking to one of the commanders, said, we haven't seen any casualty from Aydasat, which means they run and the Kurdish Peshmerga pretty much moved in. And this is for one reason. In the past, a few months ago, IS militants, they were driving in caravan, terrifying the cities, the people, the forces, and pretty much they run over cities. But now they cannot do it again. Why? Because the airstrike and the air has been so effective. Whenever a few vehicles get together, they could target them. That's why they cannot anymore use that tactic, terrifying the Kurdish forces or Iraqi forces or civilian and run over the cities. Right now, seems to me, the tide has turned and the Kurdish Peshmerga seems to be on offensive.
That was the BBC's G.R. Gol in Erbil in Iraq. I'm not big on Big Macs, but when I drive by a McDonald's, I do salivate over their fries. Salty, hot, shoestring potato fries. But if you were in Japan today and thinking of some super-sized Mickey D fries, good luck with that. In Japan, the chain has rationed its French fries, meaning customers can only buy a small. And the shortage in Japan started right here in the U.S. A labor dispute at ports on the West Coast has caused a slowdown for potato shipments to Asia. My colleague here at WGBH, Lou Olkowski, is here to explain. I know this dispute is complex, Lou, so break it down in simple terms. What is it all about?
Well, basically, we are in the middle of a contract negotiation between the ILWU, which is the Longshore Union, and the PMA, the Pacific Maritime Association, who are the employers. And in some ways, it's a normal contract negotiation. Negotiations generally, you know, this negotiation started in April, got down to business in earnest in July when the contract, previous contract, ended. And now, you know, there seems to be tension. And but if you look at a similar contract 2 years ago, also by December, there's tension. But what I think people are sensing is that, you know, in October, there was congestion at the ports of L.A. Long Beach, where the ships were sitting in the harbor and not able to come in.
Long Beach, California.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And now people are seeing that it's hard for things to get out. And so there's fries, but also apples and hay and all kinds of different products that aren't getting out. And so I think what's different now than previous negotiations is I think there's a fear that this is going to spill over into the new year and that there's some sticking point that we don't know, of course, that means this negotiation is going to go for a little while.
What does this all look like out on the West Coast? I know you did a multi-series report recently about West Coast ports. You've been there. I've only seen them in the Lethal Weapon movies. I know there's Long Beach, Los Angeles, Seattle. What are these ports like?
Well, the ports I know are L.A. and Long Beach. And L.A. and Long Beach are the two largest and busiest ports in the country. So when you are there, basically what you see are acres and acres and acres of containers and cranes, and the Pacific Ocean.
Right.
But, you know, they're so important because basically about 40% of everything, you know, we buy as Americans, like we bring in, comes through L.A. Long Beach, those two twin ports. And ILWU workers, you know, work in both of those ports.
So I guess I understand how important these ports still are to a corporation like McDonald's, but how much of world trade is still dependent on shipping by sea? I mean, I know it's way cheaper than air, but not all products can sit on a boat for several weeks, right?
No, everything is shipped by
really?
Boat. Very few. I think very little is shipped by air. It's just so much more expensive. And what I have had people tell me again and again is, like, you know, cargo is like water. It always finds the cheapest route. And the cheapest route is, in fact, water.
So any chance that this whole sticky issue is going to be resolved soon? Or are the Japanese just going to have to stick it out with small fries now?
I think they might have small fries until at least the new year. I don't know. As I said, no one knows but the PMA and the union, the ILWU.
Well, if they're not giving you the chance to supersize, then these are definitely not freedom fries. WGBH reporter Lou Olkowski, thanks.
Thank you.
News headlines are coming up next. You're listening to The World.
This podcast is supported in part by contributions from individuals like you. As we close out this calendar year, please consider a gift to PRI and help us to keep on top of the stories that you care about. Our mission is to create a more informed, engaged world. Won't you join us? Please visit PRI.org/give and support PRI today.
I'm Marco Werman. You can't see the interview, but I'll speak to someone who has, and later questioning the use of faith as a tool of torture.
There's nothing about being a Christian that gives any sort of defense for that abuse and manipulation of other people's relationship to the divine.
Ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It's Friday, so let's go catch a movie.
3 weeks from tonight, I will be traveling to Pyongyang, North Korea, to interview President Kim Jong-un.
Nope, it's not going to be that one. But will we ever get to see the interview? Sony Pictures seems to be saying no. The latest news is that Sony is not going to release the movie about a plot to assassinate North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in any form. Not straight to video, no pay-per-view, nada. So now I'm very curious what it's all about. It just so happens that my colleague here at The World, Nina Porzuki, recently saw it. What's the deal, Nina? How'd you get to see it?
Yep, got to see the movie. Didn't realize that I would be the only one. No, I saw it recently. There was a screening at the Brattle in Cambridge. Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, the writer, were there.
Was this a press screening? And
No, it wasn't a press screening. Seth Rogen was participating in a Harvard lecture about humor and politics, and afterwards they passed out a flyer saying, like, hey, if you actually want to see the movie, come tonight. And now it seems like I'm one of the few that have seen the film, I guess.
This is the night before the Sony hack, you know, the news that Sony was digitally invaded by some outside force, right?
Yeah. This was actually the night before the news broke about the Sony hack. And there had already been news like the previous April, I believe, saying North Korea was very, you know, not pleased with the movie coming out and la la la. And so Seth talked a little bit about why the idea came to him and Evan Goldberg to make this film, which actually the idea came many years before. It was supposed to be about Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un's dad.
And this is Seth Rogen.
And this is Seth Rogen talking about it.
The idea came about from we would just – it was kind of like anecdotal, conversational. Like we'd be like, oh, you know, like Mike Wallace interviews Osama bin Laden. Like he's in a room – like journalists are – in a position to be in a room with very elusive, dangerous people, hypothetically. And I'm not saying they should kill them, but were they so inclined, they would be in a good position to do that.
And actually, interesting enough, the first part of the film is a sort of like commentary about news media today. You know, it stars James Franco, who's this Dave Skylark, smarmy, you know, anchorman. And Seth Rogen's character, he plays this producer, Aaron Rappaport, who's kind of has this sort of idealistic view about like, whoa, I can do some like hard-hitting news. And yet suddenly he got saddled with a Skylark guy doing these crazy sort of stunts, but getting good ratings.
Now, again, you saw them speak and you saw the movie just hours before the news of the Sony hack. And Seth Rogen at this lecture, he actually spoke about North Korea's response to the film or what it might be, yeah?
Yeah, sure. He was asked by actually the moderator, who was the Harvard Lampoon president, Alexis Wilkinson, and she asked them this question. Listen to that.
I mean, are you like at all fearful that they like actually do something?
Not really, no. I mean, I would hope they have better things to do. Don't take that as a challenge. Yeah, I mean, I would hope they have better things to do.
Yeah, well.
Famous last words.
Yeah, his answer is slightly different today, isn't it? So finally, Nina, I've heard all sorts of rumors. Was it a good film? Did you like it?
Well, I laughed. The first part was really funny, but, you know, like, I did somewhat find myself feeling a little bit queasy about laughing about this guy when there is a lot of like human rights abuses in North Korea. And we actually brought up that topic at the lecture itself. Like, when is it okay to be funny about these things? Are there some things that you should just not joke about? And Seth Rogen had some interesting thoughts about that as well.
I think you have to be able to defend your own material on an intellectual and moral level. I would never make a joke that I think would get a laugh that has a political view that I don't personally believe in, because I might get asked about that one day and I don't want to look stupid.
So to be fair, there is actually a scene when James Franco's character, Dave Skylark, actually has a moment of realization too about the horror behind Kim Jong-un. And it has to do with like fake grapefruits, because there's a part of the movie where he's actually like walking by. They take him on a tour of Pyongyang, and there's the famous like grocery store filled with like fruits and vegetables and people shopping, and there's like a fat kid out front, like they feed their people. And then he goes past the same grocery store and it's all these ceramic fruits, and so he throws a ceramic grapefruit in the air and has this moment like, he's lying to me. So there was a moment sort of like what you see and what you don't see.
Yeah, well, the bottom line is sometimes it's just really hard to write a punchline around starvation. The World's Nina Porzuki, thank you for telling us about this movie that I hope someday some of us will get a peek at.
I have a feeling it'll be online, Marco.
Some are comparing the interview to a 1940 comedy that also took aim, at least indirectly, at a sitting leader. That movie is Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator.
Under the new emblem of the double cross, liberty was banished, free speech was suppressed, and only the voice of Hinkle was heard.
Hey, the Strafnitz Hildensekt! The Wiener Schnitzel mit der Lagerbeeren und der Sauerkraut! Hey, ich play noch Straf mit der...
Chaplin there, playing Hinkle. coughing like Hinkle, a very thinly veiled Hitler-like character. Film critic and historian David Thompson is one of those who've noted the parallels between the films. He says Chaplin's 1940 classic also raised security concerns.
Initially, when he proposed the film, there were fears, in Britain particularly, where appeasement was still very much in the air, and there was talk that the film would be dangerous. By the time it was ready, by the end of 1940, the world was at war, and it was clear that there was no getting out, and the film became a huge success. Now, it did not assassinate Hinkle, and it may be that it was a lot funnier than the interview. I don't know. I've not seen the interview. But the film had a huge impact at the time and was really rejoiced in.
Was The Great Dictator banned in Germany and the other Axis powers, like in Italy and Japan?
Yeah, it wasn't shown there until after the war. In fact, I don't think it was shown in Germany for a very long time. The story is that Hitler himself saw it. Somehow a print was taken there. And the story says that he saw it twice. But no, it did not play in Germany at all. But of course, a lot of films from the Allied countries were not playing in Germany by that time.
What was the media reaction to The Great Dictator when it came out in 1940? And how do you see the media response today differing from that, the media response today to the interview?
In 1940, the world was in great, great peril. But it had a very, very stable media climate. The film was reviewed very favorably. It was a huge popular success. It was probably Chaplin's most important feature film and the one that did best at the box office. People loved it. It's a classic. That was a feeling set up very quickly after the film opened. Today, we have less immediate physical peril, but we have a chaotic, hysterical media scene. And within a few days, this can become almost a terrorist incident. And the silly thing is that eventually, I suspect, the interview will be seen. And people will sit back and say, well, what was all the fuss about?
You know, a lot of observers have been pointing the finger at mass media and saying we have been kind of stirring the pot here and getting things amped up to the way they are. But as far as Sony's response to these threats, how do you think they should have responded?
I've not seen the film. I've not read the screenplay. I'm only going on press reports. In my opinion, that's all it is. Once the film had been made, they should have stood by it. I think the threats were idle. I don't think the people hacking could have delivered the threats. And now we have a situation where a major entertainment company hasn't proved itself to be very, very vulnerable to this kind of blackmail.
I wanted to finally ask you a bit about what Chaplin said about his own film, The Great Dictator, after World War II. He had said, had I known of the actual horrors of the German concentration camps, I could not have made The Great Dictator. I could not have made fun of the homicidal insanity of the Nazis. So now we're talking about North Korea. Are there things too serious to joke about in films, do you think?
Well, that's a matter of the talent and the taste of a filmmaker. Chaplin said that in his autobiography in the early 60s, and I think that's a reflection of the way in which most people learned at the end of the war just how horrific German practices had been. And I think he was shocked and felt that it was maybe not the subject to make humor over. But that doesn't mean that you can't do it. And I think one of the great things in the human creative spirit is that there's always the chance to take a fresh line on anything at all.
Film critic and historian David Thompson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to the recent Senate report on CIA torture, we are now familiar with some very troubling methods the agency used to interrogate terrorism suspects, like who had ever heard of rectal rehydration before. Far less attention has been given to a kind of abuse that ex-detainees have described as the worst of all, that abuse focused on the Muslim faith of detainees. And it turns out some Americans of faith have a real problem with what went on. The World's Matthew Bell reports.
When reports about abuses of Iraqi prisoners by U.S. military personnel at Abu Ghraib came out more than a decade ago, Michael Peppard got to work. He's an assistant professor at Fordham University's Department of Theology. Peppard started researching accounts of prisoner abuse, and he noticed a troubling pattern. U.S. interrogators were using the religious faith of Muslim detainees against them. Peppard says at first he didn't believe some of what he was reading.
For example, one of the ex-detainees described forced prostration before an idol shrine. This was before the United States government did any of its declassified reports. And I thought, well, I'll put that in my article, but you know, I'm going to say I don't think this. How likely could this be? Would the United States really do that? And then lo and behold, in the Senate Armed Services Committee report in 2009, there it was, forced prostration before an idol shrine.
The most common example of religiously themed abuse was the desecration of Qurans. This might not seem like actual torture, but Peppard points out that Muslims consider the holy book to be divine. So accounts from ex-detainees about Qurans being ripped up, kicked, or tossed into a bucket of excrement are seen as extremely grave violations. Peppard says the latest Senate report on CIA abuse does not have many new details, but it does suggest that using religion to force detainees into cooperation was a deliberate policy.
If this was an actual policy of interrogators to create a burden so great that a person's religious faith would be destroyed, that sounded to me like the exact opposite of what I believe our country ought to be representing, you know, in its first and greatest liberty.
Well, when I was at Guantanamo Bay back in 2002 and 2003, religious persecution against the prisoners at Guantanamo, I would say, was very widespread.
That's James Yee, who served as the U.S. Army's Muslim chaplain at the detention facility in Cuba.
You had misuse of religious symbols, like the Star of David, which is found on the Israeli flag, used to try and incite the prisoner when it was wrapped around a shackled detainee in an interrogation room. To forced shaving of beards. Some Muslims hold that having a beard is obligatory according to their religious tradition. So these types of things were taking place when I was there at Guantanamo.
Yi says there was a sense that the Geneva Conventions did not apply. The gloves were off and any Muslim could be a target. In 2003, Yi himself was charged with aiding the enemy in relation to his work with prisoners at Guantanamo. He spent 2.5 months in solitary confinement. In 2004, all charges against him were dropped. Marissa Eggerstrom is a PhD candidate at Harvard writing about the history of torture. She's also working toward ordination in the Episcopal Church. Eggerstrom says religious abuses against Muslims in U.S. custody should be especially abhorrent for Americans of the Christian faith.
There's nothing about being a Christian that gives any sort of defense for that abuse and manipulation of other people's relationship to the divine.
A recent poll conducted by the Washington Post suggests that many American Christians feel otherwise. A solid majority of respondents who identified themselves as Christian said that CIA treatment of terrorist suspects was justified. Michael Peppard of Fordham University, who's a practicing Catholic, says it's not clear why.
It is deeply ironic, paradoxical, and troubling that those who worship Jesus Christ, who was tortured and executed by state power, by overwhelming state power, that those who profess belief in Jesus Christ would support the torture of anyone.
But many Christians might be thinking more about partisan politics than the message in the gospel. Joe Carter is with the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, and he's written forcefully against the practice of torture following the September 11th attacks.
When it comes to your own country's existential existence, then it becomes a little more, let's do whatever we can to make sure that we protect our people and protect our way of life. Once the issue hit home, people were more accepting of an issue they probably wouldn't have tolerated before. And I think that's kind of sad that they put their nationalistic security issues above the gospel of Jesus.
There's another takeaway from that Washington Post survey. More than half of respondents who described themselves as atheists said they had a problem with the CIA's treatment of prisoners. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
We're coming into award season, but here's an award we don't usually pay attention to, the Keeper of the German Language. It's an annual prize handed out by a German language magazine. Past winners include former Pope Benedict XVI. Among this year's nominees for the award are a cabaret artist, a politician, a group of volunteer teachers, and Brad Pitt. True. Hollywood megastar Brad Pitt. He's got German ancestry and he speaks the language. In real life, not in the movies. He speaks English for the big screen. most of the time.
Now save your breath and curd your porridge. Hey, look, so what's a heck of two roof lights? The standard size frame furniture and the scotter cushions with the matching shag pack covering. Okay. Right. It's a terrible posture to the party with the blue guys.
Right. One of those guys you heard is, in fact, Brad Pitt, not speaking German and barely speaking English. In the movie Snatch, Pitt will find out at the end of January, when public voting ends, if he's the next keeper of the German language. Personally, my money is riding on the volunteer teachers. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. There are lots of things that high school kids do not want to learn. We've all been there. For some of us, it was math. For others, maybe Shakespeare. Some kids in Turkey are starting to worry they'll be forced to learn a language. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says Ottoman, the language, is crucial to preserving the history of Turkey's Ottoman past. But many disagree, and they're balking at having to learn what is essentially a dead language. Dalia Mortada has more.
İsteseler de, istemeseler de. Evet.
Our children will learn Ottoman whether they like it or not. That was a recent declaration by President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. It's the latest in a long line of pronouncements that Erdogan critics contend show the president as increasingly anti-democratic, even authoritarian. But in a region so unstable, looking back to Ottoman rule could play well. During the 6-century-long Ottoman Empire, laws, religious texts, and literature were written in Arabic script, using a mix of Arabic, Persian, and Turkish words. Very little of that remains today, and the Turkish language is now written using the Latin script. But what's most visible are gorgeous old tombstones towering in graveyards scattered all over Turkey.
I met a man named Mustafa visiting the tombs that surround Eyüp Mosque, a legendary historical site and the burial grounds of Ottoman sultans and pashas. My ancestors are actually buried here.
Bence. Benim ana dilim.
Mustafa says ana he wishes he could read these gravestones. It's exactly the argument that Erdogan makes, and it really resonates, for me too. Turkey's history is inscribed in these tombstones, and most people can't read or understand them. But like everything in Turkey, the push to teach Ottoman is laden with politics. The language is most often associated with Islam, the foundation of the Ottoman Empire, and with what some say is Erdogan's obsession to push religion on today's citizens. But Mustafa doesn't see it that way. For him, it's not about religion. It's about heritage. He says Ottoman should be his mother tongue. 17-year-old Fatih Seven says that, sure, for some people, that history, the gravestones, they might be important. But learning a new script shouldn't be required for everyone.
It's not important because people in Turkey even can't talk English. And they want to talk them foreign language. Useful, that useful. I'm sorry, I'm not bad in English.
Illustrating his point, Fatih means that learning a language that isn't used today shouldn't take precedent over other languages that are. He's in his last year of high school, so the proposed Ottoman mandate won't affect him. But he does wish Turkey's leaders cared as much about the languages of today, like English, that would get him ahead in the world, instead of worrying so much about the past. For The World, I'm Dalia Mortada in Istanbul.
So this coming Sunday will be the shortest day of the year, December 21st, the official start of winter. And this year, winter got a little colder and darker, at least in Siberia. Here's our friend Alina Simone to explain.
One of my favorite songs by beloved Russian rock band Kino is called City. And the chorus goes, I love this city, but the winter here is too long. I love this city, but the winter here is too dark. Well, this year, when Vladimir Putin decided to abolish daylight savings time, winter across Russia just got a lot darker.
On Sunday, Russia switches to wintertime and stays there forever.
That means more sunlight in the morning, less in the afternoon, and in parts of Siberia, where the clocks were turned back 2 hours instead of just one, a very early start to the day. Anya Krushelnitska grew up in the eastern Siberian city of Chita.
So the way it is now, the day starts 2 hours earlier. What it means also is the sun goes down and it's barely after 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
In order to make sure people were getting the most out of those sunny mornings, the official workday in Chita was also shifted.
The local government workers, which it's a sizable community, the local government workers now have to start their day officially at 8 a.m., not 9 a.m. as they used to.
Maybe not a tragedy to some, but it was one of the things that pushed the residents of this Siberian city over the edge. Last month, hundreds of them turned up in Lenin Square, notice it's still called Lenin Square, to protest the decision. Pretty remarkable for a conservative place like Chita.
It's normally a very passive and politically placid town. And for a public rally to happen in Chita and to draw 500 people, this is very unusual.
So why did Putin decide to plunge Russia into what some have described as eternal winter? One official reason was health. According to a sleep expert quoted by the government news agency TASS, dark mornings have a worse effect on people's state of health than dark evenings. But some people saw a darker subtext here. Back in 2011, when Dmitry Medvedev was president, he controversially switched Russia to permanent daylight savings time. We've gotten used to moving the hands of the clock back and forth every spring and autumn, and gotten used to being unhappy about it. It disrupts our biorhythms, Medvedev said. It aggravates us. Well, Medvedev's decision may have aggravated Putin. But is the health issue valid? I mean, is it really true that waking up early makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise? Or is this just something Benjamin Franklin put out there to make us late risers feel bad about ourselves? I spoke to Arkady Putilov at Novosibirsk's Institute for Molecular Biology and Biophysics. He tells me that according to his research, after controlling for factors like sleep duration, early birds aren't any healthier than night owls. So what if Russia's time shifting isn't about political one-upsmanship or health? What if it's something more innate? We tend to wake up earlier as we approach our senior years. Okay, Medvedev is 49 and Putin is 62. Chances are Putin's getting up earlier, and he thinks everyone else should too. Good morning. At first, government officials in Chita were less than sympathetic to those people who oppose the new 8 a.m. start time. Here's Anya.
And the comment of the spokesperson from the gubernatorial office was, those government employees who do not like the new order can jolly well just leave their job.
But a few weeks and 60,000 signatures on an online petition later, the government's position seemed to soften. Recently, Governor Konstantin Ilkovsky promised to evaluate the impact of the new time regime next year. He even hinted they might just get their hour back. And eternal winter could end up being kind of temporary after all. For The World, this is Alina Simone.
Well, that kind of puts the darker winter days here into perspective. The World's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Stay warm, stay bright, and have a great weekend.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues. PRI's New Voices Fund, whose donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. The PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation. By the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Noor Hall. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.